This is What's at Risk on WBZ News Radio 1030 and WBZ.com with Mike Christian of Risk Strategies Company.
Hi, I'm Mike Christian, and welcome to a special encore presentation of What's at Risk. We're interested in what you're thinking about. Send us an email at whatsatrisk@risk-strategies.com and let us know what's on your mind. Tonight on What's at Risk, we'll look at three different faces of risk. Our first guest, Dr. Charlotte Jacobs, will tell us about a forgotten pioneer in the battle against cancer, Dr. Henry Kaplan, who almost single-handedly developed the cure for Hodgkin's disease. Then we'll talk to another kind of physician, Louis Scatigna. He talks about his new book, The Financial Physician, How to Cure Your Money Problems and Boost Your Financial Health.
Just give me one good year to get my feet back on the ground.
Finally, we'll explore the new how with Nilofer Merchant, founder and CEO of Rubicon Inc.
Just give me one good year.
Doctor man, be my friend. If you can.
In the 1950s, 95% of patients with Hodgkin's disease, a cancer of lymph tissue which afflicts young adults, died. Today, most are cured due mainly to the efforts of the late Dr. Henry Kaplan. Henry Kaplan and the story of Hodgkin's disease explores the life of this multifaceted, internationally known radiation oncologist called a saint by some, and a malignant son of a bitch by others.
Oh, help me, please, doctor, I'm damaged. There's a pain.
Kaplan's passion to cure cancer dominated his life and helped him weather the controversy that marked each of his innovations. But it extracted a high price and left many casualties along the way. Most never knew of his family's struggles, his ill-fated love affair with Stanford University, or the humanitarian efforts that imperiled him.
Oh, help me, please, doctor.
Today, Kaplan ranks as one of the foremost physician scientists in the history of cancer medicine. In Henry Kaplan and the Story of Hodgkin's Disease, Dr. Charlotte Jacobs gives us the first account of a remarkable man who changed the face of cancer therapy and the history of a once fatal, now curable cancer. She presents a dual drama, the biography of this renowned man who called cancer his Moby Dick, and the history of Hodgkin's disease, the malignancy that he set out to annihilate. The book recounts the history of Hodgkin's disease first described in 1832. The key figures, the serendipitous discoveries of radiation and chemotherapy, the improving cure rates, and the unanticipated toxicities. Charlotte Jacobs, MD, is a professor of medicine at Stanford University. All right, we're here with Dr. Charlotte Jacobs, the author of Henry Kaplan and the Story of Hodgkin's Disease. So just to start with the basics, what exactly is Hodgkin's disease and how prevalent was it in the 1950s?
Hodgkin's disease is a malignancy, a cancer of lymph tissue. So it usually starts in lymph glands in the neck or in the chest, but eventually spreads to lymph nodes throughout the body, then gets into the bloodstream and spreads to other organs, such as lung or liver. And in the 1950s, when Henry Kaplan started his career, virtually everyone died from Hodgkin's disease. There were then and are now about 8,000 new cases per year. So it's not one of the more common cancers, certainly not like lung or breast, but it particularly afflicts young adults, and that's what makes it particularly poignant.
Maybe you could just give us a little bit of background on Dr. Kaplan's career before he got so inspired to go after Hodgkin's disease in the way that he did.
Well, Henry Kaplan is, although not a household name, is one of the major figures in cancer medicine. So those of us in the cancer world know him or knew him quite well. At the age of 16, he pledged at his father's funeral to cure cancer. That was fairly unlikely because he was in Chicago, it was the Depression, and his family was left destitute. In addition, he had two giant fingers on his right hand, congenital abnormality, so that also was problematic. But he went on to design the linear accelerator that revolutionized the treatment of cancer with radiation, not just Hodgkin's disease, but all of cancer. He struggled all through his early years because the family was so destitute, yet his mother was determined that he was going to be someone great since she felt so terrible about his fingers. And he eventually went through medical school and trained in radiology. And radiation oncology was barely a field then.
How was cancer treated sort of pre-Dr. Henry Kaplan?
Well, they had radiation. They had what's called kilovoltage, or very low voltage radiation, that emanated from when X-rays were discovered by Rentgen back at the turn of the century. But initially, they used radiation almost like a cautery because they realized that if they weren't careful, you'd get burns from radiation. Chemotherapy wasn't even discovered until 1943, or actually early 1950. So a lot of patients were, surgery was really the best treatment that there was at that period in time. But Hodgkin's disease, if you treat it with surgery, it just comes back and patients go on to die.
Now, was Kaplan one of the first to discover that cancer was caused by a virus or stimulated by a virus?
Well, he was, I would call him one of the human tumor virus hunters, and there weren't too many. He initially was just trying to understand how cancer came about and didn't even really associate it initially with a virus until a physician on the East Coast found that a virus had caused a cancer in hens. But he did go on to find a virus that caused tumors in mice. And he was pretty determined to find a virus that caused any kind of cancer, but particularly looking at lymphomas or cancer of lymph glands, of which Hodgkin's disease is really kind of a subset. And with this, he was in a race with Robert Gallo, who most people know because of his AIDS fame and his identification of an AIDS virus. But it was an arduous task, and when Kaplan died, he had never isolated a virus that causes lymphoma, even though he came very close. Eventually, Gallo did, but it was quite a race.
So his focus on Hodgkin's disease was really evolutionary. He didn't set out to cure Hodgkin's. It was just through his research that he ended up at that point.
Yes, he took this disease for which most patients were just sent home to die, or got serum therapy or surgery, but not very effective. And he started out first by finding out how the disease spread in the body. He then developed the linear accelerator, which is one of his claims to fame, in order to really deliver high doses of radiation, which are important in controlling the disease. He then designed what we call the radiation fields, or how you treat it. If people just treated the lymph node that had cancer in it, it just spread to the next lymph node. So he kind of jumped the gun and started treating areas where it was most likely to spread next. Then when chemotherapy finally was found to have some efficacy, he combined chemotherapy with radiation. These weren't without toxicities, and he was very big at trying to figure out how to mitigate any of the toxicities. He also made most of the progress with his colleague Saul Rosenberg through the use of what we call randomized clinical trials, which no one else was doing at that time, where they would pit this new therapy against what was considered the standard or palliative therapy. So they step by step made improvements in the disease. And they were also the first to use what's called the multidisciplinary approach to cancer. So Kaplan knew he couldn't do it alone, and he gathered a team at Stanford University of surgeons, medical oncologists, radiologists, pathologists, an entire team to approach this disease, and then set up some international teams to attack this disease. So this so-called multidisciplinary approach is used at cancer centers across the world now, and he was one of the initiators of that. But I have to say, I love the title of your show, What's at Risk, because I think of Kaplan as the ultimate risk taker. With every single innovation, he not only risked patients' safety and well-being, but he risked his own reputation because he was considered a maverick, and some people actually called him an absolute nut. But also, I think of the patients as the ultimate risk takers, because those who participated in clinical trials or volunteered for clinical trials in that day and age where treatments were pretty rudimentary, they really made the progress and allowed the advances to be made. And Kaplan always underscored that none of the advances could have been made in the treatment of cancer without patients taking the risks that they did and participating in new treatments.
Yeah, that's for sure. We always have to take a risk to create new innovations and new ways of doing things.
Speaking with Dr. Charlotte Jacobs, the author of Henry Kaplan and the Story of Hodgkin's Disease.
I find it interesting on the personal side, and I don't know if this comment was in your book or not, but you know, he was called a saint by some and a malignant son of a bitch by others. That's a pretty wide spectrum of views. How was he viewed?
Well, that's what made him so fascinating. I have to say, that's one of the reasons I chose him as to do my first biography, because he was so multifaceted. And as it was said, you either loved him or hated him, but he didn't generate neutral feelings. So he was beloved by his patients. He was a compassionate physician who would do anything for his patients. So in that regard, he was beloved. He was beloved by his students who fostered their careers. And he was revered by scientists all around the world and cancer physicians. But he had a passion. He had a passion to cure cancer. And he almost had blinders on in that approach. He lacked patience and he lacked political savvy. He just had no time to kind of be nice to people and tend to their feelings, except for patients, and just pushed ahead and would fight to the nth degree in order to try to cure cancer. So that he created a lot of enemies, and he wanted to see not only that he was treating Hodgkin's disease properly, but he wanted treatment to be superb across the world, not only for Hodgkin's disease, but for patients in general with cancer. So he would do battle with people at conferences and in the press, and didn't care about his own reputation. He didn't care about name-calling. He wanted to cure cancer. In fact, he told his wife that he felt like Captain Ahab and that cancer was his Moby Dick.
Right. That's a great analogy. When he, at the end of his life, was he satisfied with what he had accomplished?
I don't think so. I think he actually made a statement about what he'd like to be remembered for to a journalist. I think he was satisfied that he had improved the cure of Hodgkin's disease significantly. I think he was very proud of developing the linear accelerator, which is the radiation machine used today, and its use for cancer patients around the world. I think he was dissatisfied because he felt he had left a lot of chapters undone. He was only in his 60s. He hadn't found the cause of Hodgkin's disease. He was working on looking for viruses in lymphoma. He was developing monoclonal antibodies to treat cancer. He had a whole variety of things ongoing, and he certainly hadn't perfected the treatment of Hodgkin's disease to in his own mind. So he was so frustrated because he felt he had left all these chapters undone.
You've sort of renewed his legacy or brought it back to life a little bit with your book. Do researchers and the medical profession, do they look to Dr. Kaplan as an innovator and a pioneer?
Oh, yes. Yes, I've gotten many letters from around the country thanking me for bringing this back to life. I think he is seen as one of the greatest legends in cancer medicine. But it is ironic that as he was dying, he told his son that fame was fleeting, and he knew that someday he'd just be a footnote in a cancer textbook. I just kind of, I took that as a challenge to not let that happen.
Well, you've definitely brought him back to life in the book, Henry Kaplan and the Story of Hodgkin's Disease. Dr. Jacobs, thanks so much. How can we find out more about the book?
Well, it's available at bookstores or on Amazon to purchase.
You're the best thing that I've ever found. Handle me with care.
In good times or bad, the financial physician is the perfect prescription for everyone's financial future. These times certainly aren't good. The economy is still in free fall, and people everywhere are struggling to survive. Unemployment remains at record peaks, business closures are epidemic, and foreclosures have gone through the roof. Lives are being shattered, and millions of people are scared to death. They don't know what to do or where to turn. The Financial Physician, How to Cure Your Money Problems and Boost Your Financial Health by Louis Skatygna, examines the 25 most common causes of financial problems. By making analogies to physical health, it explains in clear, straightforward language why each problem occurs and gives the readers practical, well-tested, no-nonsense advice. A treatment section included in each chapter tells readers what to do and what not to do in order to avoid and cure their money illnesses and enjoy vigorous financial health. Some of the topics in Louis Skatygna's book include costly mistakes we make in buying homes, new cars, and insurance, how we're swamped by mortgages and debt, pursuing the wrong savings, investment, and borrowing strategies, insufficient spousal teamwork, falling victim to incompetent or unethical financial advisors, and how our psychological makeup affects our financial success. Louis Skatygna, a veteran certified financial planner and president of AFM Investments, has been advising families on practical financial management for more than 25 years. As the host of the top-rated radio program, The Financial Physician, Skatygna has diagnosed and treated the financial ills of listeners for more than 10 years.
We're speaking with Louis Skatygna, the author of The Financial Physician. Now, Lou, in your practice, you've used health as sort of an analog for personal finances. Why don't people pay as much attention to their financial health as they do their physical health?
You know, you would think that we'd spend more time dealing with our finances than we really do. And we don't. We're too busy doing other things. We're too busy spending money, usually, to worry about our finances. But I think people are just turned off to it. It's numbers, it's budgeting, it's doing without. I think we just kind of push that to the side until it's actually too late.
Yeah, that's unfortunate. So maybe this is a good, I can ask if you can give us some examples of financial irresponsibility, which I know you go into in some detail in your book.
Well, the first part of irresponsibility is illiteracy. We are financially illiterate in this country. We just don't know much about money. You know, it's amazing in high school we're taught all kinds of different subjects that we'll never use in our entire life, but we don't teach our kids about credit cards and mortgages and taxes, something that they're going to use their entire life. I believe it should be mandatory that you had a personal finance course in high school, at least 2 years, but it seems that high schools and colleges don't really want to do it. They want to teach us things that we're never going to use in our life. So most of us are financially illiterate. We don't understand how money works. So if we don't understand how the game is played, obviously we make mistakes. So the first thing we really want to do is try to educate ourselves. Read two or three personal finance books per year. There's so many great websites available to learn about finances, because the more we know, the chance of financial success is greater. Financial irresponsibility, well, buying houses that we couldn't afford, buying cars, buying new cars all the time versus buying used cars, using credit cards to buy things that we want but we really don't need. I mean, the last 30 years in this country has been the most prosperous that any civilization has ever experienced, and we got used to that. And unfortunately, it was built on an illusion, the illusion of debt and spending. And now, unfortunately, it's come home to roost on us, and times going forward are going to be much more difficult than they have been in the last 30 years. So we have to change our financial behavior. We have to become much more responsible with our money.
And do you think, in your experience, this recent financial meltdown has caused people to rethink their priorities?
Absolutely. Whether they wanted to or not, they're being forced to rethink their priorities. Take homes, for instance. Back in the 1950s, the average square foot of a home was about 900. Now it's about 2,700. So we've basically tripled the size of our houses, and at the same time, the size of a family has declined. So, you know, we're becoming a little crazy, a little irresponsible. We want a bigger house. We want brand new, beautiful cars. You know, when I was a kid, 1966, I was 6 years old, my father bought his first new car. It was a Ford station wagon. Well, in 1977, I turned 17. That's 11 years later, I inherited that car, and I had it for 3 years. We don't see people keeping cars for 14 years anymore. 3 years, maybe 4 years, we go get a new car. And that's really killed us financially. We're just burdened with so much debt payments that it's very difficult for the average family to put money away for the future.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I inherited a 1962 Impala, by the way. Nobody even knows what an Impala is anymore.
All right. But you know what? You probably loved it, got it year round, you were happy to have it. Nowadays, kids, they turn 17 and they go to their parents, I want a new car, or I want a $10,000 Jeep or something like that. You know, the younger generation really has lived in a time where we were totally irresponsible financially. And unfortunately, if you're younger than 45 years old, you've never lived through tough times. They don't know what it's like, but tough times are here, and they're going to be here for a long time. And the good part about it, I think, like you said earlier, people are going to start rethinking the way they manage their money. They're going to become more frugal, less consumerism, less credit cards. They're going to be forced to do that, and I think that's a good thing in the long run. The worst debt is credit card debt. I call it the cancer to the financial body. You got to avoid credit card debt. Once we get into too much of the credit cards, it's almost impossible to get out.
And the reason for that is just the near usurious interest rates that are charged, right?
Oh, it's just totally outrageous. I mean, the new Credit Card Act goes into effect this month. But what all the credit card companies did is they raised everybody's interest rates prior to the law going into effect. And if you miss one payment, if you're a day late, they could change your interest rate from 7% to 30% overnight. And many of these banks have done that, and it's caused quite an outrage. When interest rates are basically zero on your savings, how could they be charging us 25%, 23%, 30% in some cases? It's thievery.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, now she's gone, but I don't worry, 'cause I'm sitting on top of the world.
Time for a CBS News update. We'll be right back with more What's at Risk.